Revelation 13:11. In the past 3 or 4 weeks, we were talking about the dragon who emerged from the sea, and that he was Satan. We talked about the first beast to emerge from the sea, and his name, that he was the Antichrist. We had the whole conversation about the dragon making war on Christ in the heavens, in the earth, and then upon his offspring after he was caught away. So now we're going to talk about another beast coming up out of the sea. And I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. Remember that the beast from last week had 10 horns, and then he had 3 of the horns were destroyed. 7 of them were remaining, and an 8th horn emerged, and that was the Antichrist. All right, so this beast has 2 horns. And he spoke as a dragon. One of the things that, 2 horns like a lamb, he spoke as a dragon. One of the things that, if you understand at all the mythology of dragons or the whole dragon lore, that you realize is, and of course it all flows from the great myths of the ancient world, which doesn't mean it was false. It means the mysteries. That word doesn't mean false. But in dragon lore, dragons are beautiful. They are beguiling. You don't ever want to, in the ancient lore, you don't ever listen to the voice of a dragon, because he will seduce you. You will find yourself following him. He is serpentine in his tongue and in his look, and will lead you astray. He will try to get you to covet and to lust, usually after money or power. These are all part of the lore of dragons. And so when he says here to these people who are hearing this, remember, John's writing to a people in a culture. He's using terms they understand. So he says here that this second beast has 2 horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon. In other words, he was slick. He had power, but he was not threatening, as opposed to the beast who came out like a lion, roaring but having no teeth. Okay, he exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence, so he's able to do whatever the first beast could do. When he's in the presence of that beast, he can also do that. We're talking about signs and wonders. He makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. This particular beast causes everybody else to worship the first beast. Part of what we see about him is he's a religious figure. His purpose and intent is to cause the world to fall down and worship the Antichrist. He's a religious leader. He is he's an archbishop for the Antichrist. He's the head of the Antichrist church, is basically what he is. He makes the earth and those who dwell in it worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. We talked about last week how one of the things that happens to the Antichrist is he appears to have a fatal head wound. He appears to die, and then he is resurrected. And this resurrection, or this faux resurrection that he goes through, causes the world to follow after him as if he is the Christ. But he's not the Christ, he's the Antichrist. Okay? He performs signs so that he even makes fire come down from out of the heaven to the earth in the presence of men. Now, this was one of the prophetic miracles of the Old Testament prophets. One of the things that they would do from time to time in various circumstances is they would call down fire from the heavens, either upon a sacrifice or upon people or whatever. And so when John is talking to these people, he says he has this level of spiritual power, these kinds of signs and wonders, the same ones that you've seen the prophets of old have. He deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which was given him to perform in the presence of the beast. So these miracles, these signs and wonders are used to deceive people, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. We talked about this is the head wound. We talked about Nero Redivivus last week. And there was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, and the image of the beast might even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Remember that the Antichrist sets up this image, this of himself. He sets it up in the temple, and he causes sacrifices to be made to it, and everybody to bow down. And what John is saying is that this false prophet is able to make this image speak, to be alive, to speak as if it's alive. And then he has anybody killed who will not sit down and worship it. So, second beast is a false prophet, religious leader. He has great authority and power like the Antichrist. He causes the people to worship the Antichrist. He uses signs and wonders to deceive the world. He raises up an image of the Antichrist to be worshipped. Now, emperor worship is the significant and blasphemous claim that brings a great conflict ahead in John's day and theoretically in the eschaton. One of the things that John was dealing with, that the church of not only the Jews but also the Christians were dealing with in the first century, was the claim of emperor worship. Emperor worship started with Julius Caesar, and it started after he was dead, as a kind of honorific to Julius Caesar for his great accomplishments. It was said that he was even a god. He was divine. But it was not said about them while he lived, nor did he make such a claim. As time went on, it became common to bless the dead emperors by calling them divine. Well, what happened is we began to get through some sicko emperors, and there were a number of those, and they began to claim that they were divine while they were alive, and to require worship as divine. Claudius was one, Commodus was one, Nero to some extent. That was mostly his sycophants that led Nero's emperor worship. But there was different ones. And so what happened is that if you would not bow down and worship the emperor as God, then you were subject to total penalty. You know, whatever penalty they felt like at the moment, when very often you were sent into the arena to be made sport of. I think you probably would have a very hard time getting a grip on the whole process of arena sporting that went on during this particular time. When a people begin to be totally decadent and they find that simple pleasures no longer satisfy them, they go after more and more worse and worse, more corrupt, more and more perverse pleasures, until eventually what happens is that baseball goes to roller derby, and roller derby goes to, you know, whatever. Roll. Yeah, something. And so eventually what happens is what people want to see is, they want to see slaughter. They want to see death. And yeah, this is what happened in Rome, and it wasn't the first place it ever happened. So that they began to pit gladiators against each other, and after a while, that wasn't even good enough, so they began to pit lions and tigers and dogs against women and children. They would have these great spectacles, like, you know, day we, you go, like, for instance, 4th of July, you go to the Kennedy Center or whatever. They got all these fireworks and all this kind of stuff. Well, in Claudius' day, in Commodus' day, even in Domitian's world, Vespasian's world, what they would do when they would have nighttime games is they would crucify 40, 50 people and set them on fire, in order to provide pageantry and beauty to their spectacle. So there was all this going on, and if you failed to worship the emperor, you were subject to being penalized anywhere from in a place where it wasn't too bad, having your property confiscated, all the way up to being thrown into the arena for the sport of the people. Most Romans did not work. Roman freedmen did not work. Only the slaves and the tradesmen worked. But the Roman population of freedmen didn't work, and they needed stuff to do. They were constantly visiting each other and having parties, going to the baths, getting themselves into all kinds of stuff in order to entertain themselves, because they lived in a world where everything was done for them. It's not a whole lot different than what we see if you ever read Jane Austen. If you read Jane Austen, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Emma, whatever, you see these very wealthy people, these landowners, sort of walking around the drawing room during the day, playing whist, having gossip, reading poetry, buzzing about this or whatever, scratching the lice out of their hair, you know, doing this, going hunting, all manner of things, because they have nothing to do. They have nothing to do to work. You know, some of them have figured out that it's kind of nice to go visit the poor, and so they do that. They strap that on as part of what they do. And some of them were genuinely loving and kind and did it for altruistic reasons. But they have nothing to do, and so they find ways to entertain themselves. And so it was here. Now, there was a process here that went on. What happened is that once a year you were required to come to whatever the city hall was in your particular community. You're required to pay a temple tax, or pay a, meaning the temple of the emperor, pay a temple tax, a coin, and sign a chit that said, or a note that said, that your emperor was God. Okay. Now, the Jews refused to do that. And the Romans crucified them until they were tired of crucifying them. And so they finally said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll let you slide on the God thing since you're not going to ever change your mind on that. So you don't have to sign the chip, but you do have to pay the tax. And this particular tax was particularly odious to the Jews. And so when the Pharisees were trying to get Jesus in trouble, they would say to him, Lord, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar? Should you pay this tax to Caesar? The tax they were talking about was this tax, this particular one. And they knew that whatever he said would get him in trouble. If he said, no, don't pay taxes to Caesar, they called the Romans. If he said, yes, do pay taxes to Caesar, then it made the population hate him because they hated this. So Jesus' famous answer was, is render to Caesar the things that are Caesar and to God the things that are God. At one particular point in time, Peter came to him and said, we need to pay the tax. And he said, go catch a fish. It'll be in the mouth of the fish. You remember this story? So they found this coin there. So what happens is you went down, you paid the coin, you signed the chit. And if you were Jewish, after a certain period of time, you didn't have to sign the note. You didn't have to sign the chit or the little certificate saying that you believed that the emperor was God. And as long as Christians were considered Jews, they didn't either. But when Christianity began to pull itself away from Judaism and be seen as a different religion, the Jews began to disavow them, Christians began to disavow the Jews, they suddenly found themselves standing out here thinking like Jews but not being Jews, and they were no longer under the protection. And so now they had to deal with this whole thing about the temple tax again, and this caused a number of things to happen. Either you said, I think it's a little dangerous out here, I'm going to step back over here and become Jewish again, which is, you know, not that far away. Or I'm going to learn to like lion's breath, you know. And so what happens is that people began to wiggle their way back into Judaism and abandon the claims of Christianity. The entire book of Hebrews was written to say, don't do that. That is the theme of the book of Hebrews. Don't do that. Because the first four chapters of Hebrews makes a comparison. The Jewish high priest is Aaron, and the Christian high priest is Christ. The Jewish sacrifice is on and on and on. The Christian sacrifice is once and for all. But the Jewish king is this. The Christian king is this. There's this comparison in the first four chapters between Judaism and Christianity, and it says Christianity is far superior than Judaism. Don't go back. And then in chapter 6 of Hebrews, it says, if you do go back, you will not be able to find your salvation again. You'll lose your salvation and you'll pay the penalty. So you had this whole process of emperor worship and all of its implications. And so when we have this false prophet emerging in the end times, one of the things that he is doing is pointing to the Antichrist as God. Again, this is emperor worship, as it were, revisited. Now, the Jews of John's day understood the emperor worship issue. They understood it very, very well. And so did any Christians who had been around. And so when he starts talking about the Antichrist and the fact that he is accompanied by this false prophet, this religious figure, who is the master of ceremonies for emperor worship, then they get that as well. And when he starts talking about him being empowered by Satan, they get that as well because they think of Rome as empowered by Satan. So, let's see. All citizens of the empire, I think I've covered all of this. Yeah. Alrighty, I think I have. Alright, verse 16. He causes all, the small and the great and the rich and the poor and free men and slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, and he provides that no one should be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now he, that's the false prophet, causes everyone in the world, rich, poor, great, small, free, and slave, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead, and he provides that no one should be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. Okay? Now, this sounds like a whole lot of gobbledygook, and it's really not at all. It's really very, very simple. First of all, the mark on the head and the hand relates to Jewish phylacteries. Y'all remember that Jews wear phylacteries, that praying Jews wear phylacteries. They wear, a phylactery is a little box, it's 1.5 inch square, and inside of it are four small scrolls tied up inside of it, and they wear it, they strap it to their wrist with a big leather strap, or to their arm, or here up on their head, and they do that in order to keep it close to their heart. And those four scriptures, we'll read them in a little while. Those four scriptures are basically scriptures that acknowledge who God is and whatever. And it's to remind them. And they were told by the Mosaic law that they were to do this all the days of their life. The mezuzah, for instance, when you walk up to a Jewish home and there's a little bitty small box there and people reach up and touch it and kiss it, that is just a spin-off of the phylacteries. It's just a phylactery mounted to their house. And so when John is talking about this false prophet coming along and requiring a mark here or a mark here, he's relating to phylacteries. In other words, they don't think that that's strange that you would be identified in that way. It was, for instance, the common practice of harlots to wear a thing up here in her headdress. Giving her name, that was very, very common. The high priest wore a stone that identified him and a name. We're going to see a number of references here to the idea that we are given names by God or names by the enemy, depending on whose side you're on. And so when he talks about this mark on the head and the hand, he's relating to phylacteries. Let's go to page 46 for just a minute. You can read this yourself. And I actually think I'm not going to go here. I'm going to let you read this yourself. It's pretty self-explanatory. This is just a little copy out of the Unger's Bible Dictionary of what a phylactery is, and tells you pretty much what I told you. So tonight or some other time, when you've done reading the sanctification pamphlet, you can read the phylactery page there. Okay. In John's day, this prevention from buying would have been socially forced and only locally implemented. A simple way that we would see this is ostracism. People who knew that someone was a Christian would just refuse to sell to them. There would have been a decree in some communities. Like when Quirinius was the governor and he had John arrested and sent to Patmos, he was not in the mood for a lot of bloodshed, but he was in the mood for a whole lot of ostracism. And so he would have passed a law. If you sell to one of them, if they're not one of us, you sell to one of them, your business can be forfeit. And so it was, and this is not uncommon, not just in this particular age, but in other cultures down through history. For instance, there were things that the English were not allowed to sell to the colonists. You remember that? You could not sell certain things to the colonists because they might turn around and use it against you. In fact, colonists had to sneak in. They were allowed, for instance, they had a stipend of how much gunpowder they could have and bullets, and that was just to protect themselves from the Indians. They were not allowed to stockpile it because they didn't want them to have enough for a standing army. Down through history, there's been an effort in many cultures and in many circumstances to control the trade in order to separate the us from the them. And this would have been an example of that. So John is saying that in this particular day, they will try to enforce, they will try to coerce everyone into joining with the Antichrist by refusing to let them buy the necessities of life unless they come on board and join in and are marked in such a way that they can be seen as being a part of us. Some people who are kind of like a big one world government, trilateral commissionist, those kind of people. And sometimes what they say is that we'll see a day when they'll put a chip in our forehead or in our hand that basically has all of your credit card information on it, so that when you go into a store, rather than having a credit card, which you can lose, you'll just pass your hand over the reader and then they'll be able to charge your accounts. And if you've had a bad luck and your arm's getting caught off, then they take your head and put it over the reader there, because they're pretty sure if they put one up here, you're not going to lose that one. Or if you do, it won't matter a whole lot. So, at any rate, so the idea is that you have this identifying symbol here. It sounds real hokey, but it's actually not. It's just an expression of it in symbolic form of things that they're not uncommonly done. In the eschaton, the implication is that this is legally enforced and worldwide. The number of the beast relates to the spelling of his name. Now, this also is not very hard. In the absence of Arabic numerals, and remember that the Arabic numerals didn't catch on in the ancient world for some time, way up into the AD period. In the first, second century, Arabic numerals were not widely used, and they weren't used at all much in the Roman world or in the Greek world. They were only used in the Arab world. But the Arabic numerals began to be common when we get into 4th, 5th, and 6th century, and then only among the scholars, people who are mathematicians and whatever. The absence of Arabic numerals, ancient languages gave numeric values to its alphabet. For instance, we all know that in the Roman Empire, M equals 1,000, D equals 500, C equals 100, L equals 50, X equals 10, V equals 5, and 1 I equals 1. We know this. We've seen this many times when you calculate the Roman numeral date. Every crossword puzzle in the world's got at least one of these in it at one time or the other. Some letters had no numeric value, so they were treated as zero. A person's name could be reduced to numeric value and often was. For instance, in Pompeii, a famous inscription on a wall reads, "I am in love with a girl whose number is 545. And I'm quoting from F.F. Bruce and giving you this because I know you won't believe me. So a sign on a Roman bath might say, "For a good time, call 567-4971. For a good time, call MDXLVVI. But that's the way it was. So the Hebraic or Aramaic name for Nero Caesar was 666. However, it is also the numeric name for Emperor Caesar Domitian Augustus Germanicus, which was found on a common coin of its day. So obviously, if you have various letters in your name, you could wind up with two people with the same number. And in this particular case, we have two emperors whose names work themselves out to 666. One of the things that's happening here is this is easily a good way for John to say, you know who I'm talking about, it's 666. In other words, you can figure this out just by doing the math on his name. On the other hand, you have plausible deniability. You know, he can always say, well, I never called him Germanicus. You know, how do I know that? So, anyway, we're told then that when we get to the end times, it's going to be this worldwide coercion, trade-based, in order to cause everybody to come and worship the Antichrist. We're going to have this religious pressure to come and worship the Antichrist. There's going to be lack of freedom, total monopolization of people's free will in order to cause them to come to worship the Antichrist. And we'll be able to identify this particular person because his number will be 666.
Is that literal? I mean, is this kind of a metaphorical thing? I mean, does he really mean 666? Because obviously when the Antichrist comes, that he really will have in the Roman type thing 666?
Well, the number 666 based on the Roman numerals,
yeah,
is one of about 80 languages that do that.
Okay.
Even in modern times. There are languages all over the world today that still use letter values for numeric quantities. So, I wouldn't claim to know without a shadow of a doubt. It wouldn't surprise me because he said it. He probably means it. But it also could be symbolic. I don't know. But the point is this. It was certainly not symbolic to the people he was talking to in his own day. Because he's pegged Domitian right down there, and remember that Nero was a kind of a boogeyman to everybody anyway, and either one of them represented the Roman Empire, so he was pretty safe there. But no, it's I think we can see though that if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, that you will be able to understand who the Antichrist is. Certainly as he plays his hand out and everything like that. The scripture tells us that he is so deceptive and so slick in his approach that if it were possible, even the elect would be deceived. However, it's not possible for the elect to be deceived because God will reveal himself to them. This is going to be a scenario where everybody and his brother is going to love this person, and you're going to be saying, you know, he's the Antichrist. They're going to go, pfft, you know, go away. You know what? There's Middle Eastern peace. Nobody's bombed an airplane in, 10 years. You know, go crawl under a rock. Everything's cool. So, other comments about this? Yes?
So regardless of the actual sign on the hand or the head, they will have something on their head or their hand to mark that they worship the beast.
If you take this very literal, we will have something on our head or our hand to identify us as being for the Antichrist or against it. If you take it figuratively, we will have something that will mark us as for him or against him. And since our heads and our hands are the most visible things we have about us, then it's a good symbol. So there's a lot of stuff like this that you're free to take it literal or not. It really doesn't matter. It means the same thing. Sometimes, when we first start talking about this course, I'll get to you in a minute, but Brother Bill, when we first start talking about this course, one of the first things that we said is that one of the problems with dealing with the imagery that's involved in apocalyptic writing is that it's treacherous. It's like the skier coming down the hill. If you snowplow the imagery, you'll never get to the bottom. If you just say, I just don't buy any of this imagery, then what happens is that you'll never understand anything about what you're reading. On the other hand, if you take the imagery too slick, if you get to whittling faster than you can handle it, you wind up off in the woods looking like Sonny Bono on the morning after. Because you've chased the imagery in places it doesn't want to go. And so you wind up and you're sure that it's the ghost of Ethel Merman that's coming back as the Antichrist because somebody did the math. You know what I'm saying? So, I think what happens is that we have to, there's a lot we can learn from this. There are certain symbols that are clear, and those symbols are not symbols that'll cost you. In other words, what I mean by that is it's clear when he's talking about Jesus. But, it's not like missing it's going to be a big problem, When he gets to talking about what kind of car the Antichrist drives and whether he likes these kinds of suits or that kind of suits, when people get into details that are well beyond the purview of the text, they're asking for trouble. And remember that the Jews missed the first coming in spite of all the evidence because they overrode the evidence with their expectation. And so when we create these expectations based on all these charts and everything, I got $35 in this set of charts, man. It's got to happen this way. When we do that, we set ourselves up to miss what's going on. Is that an answer? Yeah, brother.
We still look at that mark on the hand and the forehead business today in our courts. When you're asked to swear to tell the truth, you're asked to put your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand. And the reason you raise your right hand is to show that there's no mark there.
Interesting.
Sometimes when a thief was caught, they would brand the palm of his hand. Or when a murderer was accused, they would brand his hand. And that's why the palm of the hand had to be shut. To be sure you were an honorable person.
Yeah, that makes sense. I hadn't heard that. Yes?
666 in the first century have like a holy meaning?
No.
No. So it was a coincidence about you?
No, hey, John is saying, hey, the guy you got to watch out for in our day and age here, his number is 666. And in their world, they would run to the math really quickly because that's how they didn't do Arabic numbers. They didn't have twos and fours and threes and sixes. They didn't have a back eye or a abacuses, whatever you, abacuses, those two. or abaci, the plural, Latin plural. But anyway, huh?
I think everybody needs to understand that each character of the Hebrew alphabet had a numerical equivalent. And when you wrote somebody's name down and totaled up the numerical equivalents of the letters of their name, you would come up with a total number. And that's why that's why when you look at the Hebrew Torah, you can find the number of Yeshua time and time and time again in the Torah, and they couldn't see it.
Yeah.
So it's a coincidence that Nero and Domitian both.
The fact that they both equal 666 is a coincidence. John's talking about Domitian. Domitian is the emperor who's at his time. In times past, people have run to Nero because he was the more insane of the ones. But the likelihood is almost certain he's talking about Domitian, because Domitian is the emperor who has him sent away. So, okay. All right. I looked and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, with 144,000 having his name and the name of his father written on their foreheads. So what he's saying is as opposed to having the name of the Antichrist written on your forehead, God's people were going to have his name written on their forehead. And the simple way to say this is there's only those people who obviously belong to the Antichrist and those people who obviously belong to the Lord. The idea that we are all running around branded is probably taking this further than it needs to be taken. You know what I'm saying? I really don't think that we're all going to have... in fact, we wouldn't have room for it, because as we read through the imagery of the names on the forehead, we wind up having two or three of them. We have God's name on there. We have a new name that we've been given on there. Then, not to mention the cross out of the one that used to be on there when you belong to the Antichrist. So after a while, you begin to look like a bad tattoo artist, you know, up there. You know, I love Mary / Janie / Vicky / you know, Marvin. You know, can't make up his mind. The saints of God in heaven are described as having the name of Jesus and the Father written on their foreheads. I'm sure this is true, at least symbolically. The problem with literal interpretation is that at this point, they have no literal foreheads. The saints of God in heaven have no literal foreheads. Remember, they're spirits. And so we're pretty sure that they not... And if I'm going to get a glorified body and I'm going to be buff again, the last thing I want is a bad tattoo right in the middle of my head. These are spirits who have not yet resurrected. The symbol is more important than its literality. Some of this is symbolic and literal, and some is just symbolic. You just have to sort of figure out, you know, time to time where it is. Yes, sir? All right, 14:1. I'm starting off with the same verse, just so I can get a foundational statement. Go for it. I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion with him, 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. I heard a voice from heaven, like the sound of many waters, like the sound of loud thunder, and the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. Now, we talked about this before. We read Psalm 29. We talked about the fact that whenever God speaks, it's been described in the Old Testament as like the sound of many waters, like the sound of thunders. Remember I read Psalm 29 here one time, which is just one of those kind of places. If you do any reading, allegorical reading in the Christian circles, like the Francine Rivers books, those kinds of things, one of the things that you often run into is when the Lord speaks, the people say his voice was like the sound of many waters. It's a common metaphor for God is speaking. And they sang a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders, and no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. And these are the ones who had not been defiled with women, for they kept themselves purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. Now, this does not mean that they were virgins or that they were celibate. John is now drawn to the Lamb, Jesus, and his heavenly entourage, 144,000 unsullied saints of God. Parthenoi is the word that's used here. It means a masculine virgin. They have no intercourse with false religion or untruth. Now, y'all know what pagan religion is in this day that we're in. This is the pagan religion is made up of a number of things. First of all, there's a bunch of household gods. There's a bunch of statues. People use them for luck. They're good luck charms. People make sacrifices to them and that sort of thing. And then there are the process of going to church. Now, going to church in the ancient pagan world was to go to some temple somewhere and to make a sacrifice. At least half of these temples, if not 80% of them, involved sexual relationships. You went to a temple, you bowed down, you worshipped either Athena or Diana or Artemis, depending on what language you're in, whether you're in Greek or Roman or Latin or whatever, and various other deities and goddesses. And if you were a woman, you worshipped with a Parthenoi, a male priest. And if you were a man, you worshipped with a female, and you had sexual relationships in the name of this god and goddess. It was as common as people going to Mount Pisgah on Sunday. It happened all the time. It was a regular part of Roman and Greek life, particularly Roman life in the first century, and all the ancient mystery religions. All of the religions of the ancient world that were involved in sexuality are lumped under the mystery religions, the Babylonian religions. And sometimes the word Babylon is a metaphor for all of them. So when we talk about Babylon has fallen, it sounds really unusual for us that people would worship in this particular way, but this was the way it was done. And if you want to read some history on that, I point you back again to the Roman Empire by Paul Vane. This is one of the books that one of my textbooks. But once again, if you read historical fiction of the day, you'll see that this is the case. So I know it sounds strange to your ears, but that is the way it was. And so when he's talking about people who have not sullied themselves with women, he's not talking about men who aren't married. He's talking about men who have not gone to worship at these temples with the goddesses. They have had no intercourse with false religion or untruth. They are the first fruits of many more to come. In other words, God's people will be holy and pure and set apart. They will not participate in all of this idolatry. They will not participate in all of this stuff. They are the first fruits of many. They sing a song that only they can sing, the song of the redeemed. Redeemed humans have an experience not shared even with angels. Do you realize that if God has forgiven you your sins and that you are walking in harmony with God, that you have had an experience that no angels ever had? Put yourself just for a minute into this way of thinking. It is one thing to have never, ever been needy and to never lack anything. It's another thing to have been desperately hungry and needy and have somebody come along and provide for you. The enjoyment of the same thing is different. If you have never ever in your life been hungry or needed anything, the fact that you have is like, okay. If you have been starving and needy and desperate, and someone comes along and provides for you, the fact that you have is okay. I mean, it's up here. You see what I'm saying? So part of what he's trying to say is that these people, these redeemed ones, these people who have been forgiven their sins, these humans, have had an experience that the angels have never experienced. They have been lost and desolate and condemned, and they've known their degradation, and the Lord has come along and saved them, and their level of praise is a whole lot more animated than the angels. It doesn't say the angels are bad people. It just says they have no way of understanding this. One of the things that you have to know, think about this. It is perfectly feasible to understand pain intellectually. But you if you ever have pain, you'll understand it differently than intellectually. I'll give you an example, okay? I can sit around and intellectualize all I want about what it is to have a baby. Okay? I can give you a good biological description. I can read you charts and reports and things that women have said. But there's no way that I will understand the experience as you will. Somebody has told me before it's kind of like passing a watermelon. That sort of makes me understand a little bit about it. But there's no way that I can understand that because I haven't had the experience. So even the angels don't know what it means to have pain or pleasure or forgiveness. And so when we who are forgiven and cared for, are we back to the watermelon thing? When we're going through all that, our level of gratitude supersedes their capacity for gratitude by some great amount. And so what he's saying is that when these people are singing, they're singing the song of the redeemed. Yes.
Just a tiny comment, C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters.
Yeah.
It seems to be tying in here the idea that Satan, hates us because we have that, and he doesn't have it, and he's jealous.
Yes.
And all the demons
yes.
are jealous.
Yes.
And hate us.
Yeah. Satan has no mechanism for forgiveness because he had no temptation. Satan created his own sin. And so he has no... So, yes, he is very jealous of us. The ability to be redeemed and forgiven. I think we all grow up with the idea that if you have not and then you get it, you appreciate it more than if you've always had it. Well, that's what he's saying here. Their song of gratitude and praise is both unique and powerful. It's authoritative. The Lamb sings with them in the voice of many waters. I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on earth and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who has made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of water." And another angel, a second one flying, followed saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. And she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality." All right, so we remember that we've been talking about these various convergences, and that we keep looking at these experiences that people are having here, and they're all pointing back to the second coming. Well, what's happening is this is another scenario that's going on. While we were looking at this and this and this, we've also got these angels running around going, everybody needs to be happy because it's here. The time has come. The time that's been appointed has come. Give God glory. Fear him. The hour of judgment has come. And worship him, everybody upon the earth. And then another angel is going around saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon. Since the garden, Babylon, which is a metaphor for evil, the Babylonian mystery religions, Satan's kingdom, Babylon has dominated the earth since the garden. Adam and Eve fleeing the garden, running away from the garden, looking back, begin to understand a loss. And as their life goes on, that loss, that understanding of their loss gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, we've had 6,000 years of that loss. And so those who are sitting back watching this, like Adam and Eve and the people who've gone on before and the angels and whatever, they see this enormous loss that's built up. Now, a lot of people today are sort of anesthetized from seeing it because it's all they know. It's all they know. One of the things that separates the people who walk with the Lord from the people who don't is the people who don't walk with the Lord don't see the problem. They don't see the problem. So what happens is you've got this huge sense of loss, and we've read earlier in the text how the various groups, those saints who are martyred under the throne, the saints in heaven, the 144,000, all of them are crying out to God for him to come and fix this. How long, O Lord? Remember we read that earlier on? How long, O Lord, is it going to be before you fix this? Well, this angel says, you know what? It's here. Babylon has fallen. The kingdom of Satan has fallen. It is over. And she who made all the nations drink the wine of the passion of her immorality. The time has come for the truth of the gospel to manifest itself. John is telling his people to endure and remain true. I mean, the reason he's giving them this scene is so they understand if they'll hang in there, that when this rejoicing goes on, they'll be a part of it. They'll be glad they did. The last thing you want to do, I think, is to cave in, walk away from all this, and then have this come to pass. You realize what you've given away because you just didn't hang in a little longer. There will be a great reward for those who fear or respect God. The time has come for the fall of the world system, Babylon. John is warning them that to follow the world is dangerous. Babylon will fall no matter how strong and pervasive it appears. I mean, if you look at the Roman government, the Roman world, if you're a Christian in the first century being led off into the slaughter or persecuted or run from pillar to post or exiled from your property or you're in some kind of a prison camp or whatever, the Roman world is monolithic. It looks like there are not enough armies in the world to overthrow the Roman world. And we look at the same thing today. If you look around at the evil in the world, you say, you know what, evil is big. I mean, corruption is big, and the badness in us is big. And what kind of thing could possibly flip that and turn this world into a good place? It's too big. It makes us hopeless and have despair. And it's only because we have no good grip on the size of our God. We don't realize that this big monolithic structure is condemned from the beginning to fall, that it will fall, and when it collapses in upon itself, that that righteousness will reign, that the humility of a child will be seen as the good, that the kindness and love of one another will be seen as the right approach, that selfishness will be done away with because it doesn't gain us anything. That we'll find out that there really is, it is more blessed to give than to receive. In other words, the structures of the world, you know, Satan has been selling us a bill of goods forever. And the world magnifies that and jumps in on it. You know, Madison Avenue, they get in there and they keep pumping it out. You won't be happy unless you have this. And you won't get chicks unless you have this. And you know, you must have this, you must have that. And they just keep pumping it out there. And there's a simple little truth out there that floats around that's true. And that is that, you know, if you have enough and a little bit left over from good works, you have all you need. Solomon, who had 300 wives and 700 concubines, said, a man who has a job and a home and a good wife is the richest man on earth. That's what Solomon said. If you have that, you have all there is to have that's a value. You have all you need. So, John's talking about that. Another angel, a third one. So we've got a bunch of these angels. You can almost see these guys like these airplanes with these trailers behind them. You can almost see these angels flying around the sky with these banners and stuff like that above all of this. Another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast in his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. In other words, you're going to go to hell. Just pure and simple. If you sell out to the beast, you will live with the beast forever in torment. You can read through all the metaphors. You can decide for yourself what is symbolic and what's literal. The meaning is the same, and that is: if we walk with the Lord, we will enjoy His peace and love and kingdom forever. And if we walk with the Antichrist, if we walk with Satan in his kingdom, we will suffer the consequences of it forever. Progressively worsening sense of remorse and regret that just goes on and builds exponentially, and from which there is no death, from which there is no escape. You know, one of the things that happened at the garden at the fall is that God drove Adam and Eve out of the garden. And one of the reasons he drove them out of the garden was because there was a tree there called the Tree of Life. And we're told that he positioned angels at the door to the garden to keep them from getting to the Tree of Life. They had been sentenced to die. And if they went and they ate from the Tree of Life, they would live forever. And so he prevented them from getting to that Tree of Life. Now, it's easy for Satan to tell us, or for us in our logic to say, well, you know, God was just really angry with them and he didn't want them to have eternal life. Well, no, what God didn't want them to have was to be eternally, progressively evil. Because as man began to deteriorate because of the fall, and he began to get progressively evil, progressively corrupt, as your body corrupts progressively, so will our souls, our spirits, if it does not meet Christ. It'll keep progressing. We become worse and worse and worse and worse. If that goes on forever, that's a curse, not a blessing. So for humans to be able to die was a blessing because it meant the end of the risk. To go back and to eat from the tree of life and live forever in that state is the worst kind of curse that you can imagine. Yes?
At the risk of getting too much off track here, like you said, in the metaphor of the skier, it says here basically the person's going to go to hell with fire and brimstone. But what does it mean in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb? Does that mean that the angels are going to be there?
No. What it means is that while you're sitting here looking at what's going on in heaven, you will be living in hell. I mean, part of the remorse and regret is to realize this is what I could have had. We all stand before God, and when we stand before God, the Scripture says we see Him face to face because we shall be like Him. We're going to know when we stand before God, here He is. This is who He is. This is what He is. I was invited and called to this party. I was provided for this party. He made every effort to bring me to this party. And in my own stubbornness and self-will, I opted out of this party. And now I'm sorry that I did. So part of what progressive torment is I mean, if you don't know what you've lost, it's if I tell you, you've never had a something or another from Poland, it's kind of like, you don't know what you've lost, right? I mean, it's like, what's that? So no, what it means basically is you're going to know, because the angels and the Lord are all going to be there for you to look at from afar. And all these people are going to be having a good time. And here you are, here. And you know, without a shadow of doubt, that you did it to yourself. Here then is the perseverance of the saints, who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Christ, in Jesus. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds will follow them. So the saints who have believed and been faithful will be very glad. Their deeds will follow them. It is not all for nothing. We've all had this experience sometimes. It seems like that when we do the right thing, our life is hard, and other people who are doing the wrong thing seem to be getting by easier. You know, they're skating. If you do the study and you get a B- and somebody else gets the answer sheet and they get an A, and I remember when I was a kid that we were lower middle class, and I had kids in my school who were upper middle class, and they spent all their summers working at their father's offices making big money by my standards. You know, and I remember one summer I was knocking down $1.08 an hour cleaning rose bushes out of greenhouses and getting all, whatever. And these other guys were making big money. But I want to make a long story, but the bottom line is coming upon them later, I find out that I actually was prepared for something that they were never prepared for. So you can sometimes look back and say, I had a very difficult time and other people skated. But if you're wise, you can also look back and say, now that I've gotten to where I am, I'm glad that I did. You can't build muscle without the difficulty. No pain, no gain. So we have to have a rational appreciation for that, those things which are difficult that create in us those things which are good. So hanging in for the Lord has a reward, and we'll be glad we did. Perseverance in times of difficulty is a wise play. The Hebrew word for that is hesed, or blessed is he who does that. This is the central theme of John's writings, especially Revelation, that we should hang in and trust God because we will be glad that we did. All of John's writings, the Gospel of John, the three epistles of John, and the book of Revelation all say this. I looked and behold a white cloud, and sitting on the cloud was one like the Son of Man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud. Now, you know who the him is because it's capitalized in your text. Okay, put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. It's a big symbolic thing. The grapes of wrath. The Lord of the harvest enters. The time of the harvest is at hand. In Matthew 13:29. We are told the story of a man who planted a field of wheat. And in the night, his enemy came and planted weeds among his wheat out of spite in order to diminish his harvest and his reward. And so as the plants began to come up, his workers said, Master, an enemy has sown weeds in among the wheat. And they said, should we go and jerk these weeds out so that the wheat can grow well? And he says, verse 29. No, he says, allow both to grow together until the harvest. And in the time of the harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather up the tares, bind them in bundles, and burn them up, but gather up the wheat into my barn. So Jesus used parables about the Lord of the harvest, about what he was going to do at the time of the end. Now, I want you to notice that the first group gathered up is the weeds, not the wheat. One of the things we have a lot of people who get off into the idea of a pre-trib rapture and the idea that we're going to be rescued out of the tribulation, all that kind of stuff, that God is going to take his people out. Well, when Jesus' parables, the first one to be taken out is the weeds. Jesus' emphasis here is on the purification of the end time church. Believe me, when we get to the place where there's real tribulation, there won't be any lukewarm Christians. There won't be any iffy Christians. It's going to cost you to be a Christian. You either will or you won't. There's not going to be any in between. And so what's going to happen at the time of the end is those people who are with the Lord will be very much with the Lord at all cost. And those people who are not with the Lord will flee, and there will be no one in the middle. So we're told that there will be this taking out of the weeds. Well, one clear way to take care of the weeds out is to bring pressure down upon the church, and the weeds will flee. They'll leave. They'll get out of the way. Scripture talks about two men in a field and one is taken. Two people lay in a bed and one is taken. What is it meant? Is it meant that the rapture has come and that the good person is taken out? Is that what's meant? Or is he meaning what he says here, that two men are in a field and one is taken out because the church is being cleansed? The weeds are pulled out. You see, the separation of the sheep and the goats, as it were. All right. One like the Son of Man sitting on the cloud is quintessential Messiah, as reflected in Daniel 7:13. I was pressed for an answer, and so I said that that Monday night's class after this one, it will be Daniel. So I hope that will be a blessing to many of you. Daniel is another book in line of the same kind of stuff we've been studying, one which will become a whole lot clearer to you now as we go into it, if you do it. And verse 7, 11 through 14, he says, then I looked because of the sound of boastful words which the horn was speaking. Daniel is talking about the Antichrist and the boastful words he was speaking. And I was looking until the beast was slain and his body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. So the beast is cast into hell. The rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away from them, but an extension of life was granted them by an appointed period of time. And I kept looking in night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days, was presented before him. He was given dominion, glory, kingdom, etc., etc., etc. It says here, glory and kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, will not pass away. His kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. So when John is saying that, behold, I look, and sitting on the cloud was one like the Son of Man, what's he doing? He's quoting Daniel. He's speaking into images that they thoroughly understand. In this manner, Jesus used Antiochus Epiphanes as a metaphor for the Antichrist. Now, when we study Daniel, we're going to understand who this man of desolation or man of destruction was. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes or Antiochus IV. But he says here in Matthew 24:15, he says, when you see the sacrifice made, huh? There's a phrase I'm catching.
Desecration.
That's right. When you see the desecration that makes desolate, he says, when you see that, and he points backwards to Antiochus Epiphanes, when you see that, then you'll know the Antichrist is here. Now, what happened was, is Antiochus Epiphanes was a Seleucid emperor. He was a Syrian, and he basically was trying to make the Jews become Hellenist or Greek in their thinking. He wanted to destroy their unique religion because it was causing him problems. And so after he could not entice them, or at least all of them, to become Hellenist, because many Jews did become Hellenist, he brought a statue of Zeus. He set it up in the temple and he slaughtered hogs to it. When he did, a group of the high priest family, the Maccabees, rose up, and over a period of time they drove him and his people out. And when he caused the sacrifice to cease for 1125 days, but then they drove him out. And when they drove him out, they restored the temple, or they reconsecrated the temple. And once they did, then they set the light of God back in the Holy of Holies. And the light of God in the Holy of Holies burns a special anointed oil. And they only had one vial, a day's worth, and it takes 8 days to consecrate this oil. And so what happened is they burned this one vial, and it miraculously lasted 8 days while they consecrated more. And this the Jews celebrate as the Feast of Hanukkah, or the Feast of Lights. So anyway, he's pointing back to Antiochus Epiphanes, someone the Jews know like the back of their hand, and pointing forward to the Antichrist and says, he'll be like that. And another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven. He also had a sharp sickle. And another angel, one who has power over fire, came out from the altar. And he called out with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. Here's the grapes of wrath. And the angel swung his sickle in the earth, and he gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came up from the winepress up to the horses' bridles, for a distance of 200 miles. Now, that's a lot of blood, folks. There was a million people at the mall, you know. When I say there's a million people at the mall, I'm using a part of speech known as hyperbole. It's a descriptive term designed to let you know there's a lot. I'm not considered a liar or scientifically naive when I say that. I must have told you 1,000 times. Well, actually, Daddy, you've only told me 875 times. The idea is that it's hyperbolic. And so what he's saying here is that when this particular point in time, when the wrath of God comes, that he's going to send his angels, they're going to put in the sickle, and they're going to harvest enough grapes so that when he puts them in the winepress of his wrath and steps on them, that the blood will rise up as high as a horse's bridle for 200 miles. Now, that's a lot of blood. In other words, what he's saying is that's going to be a mess. The wrath of God falling upon the earth is going to be devastating, widespread, beyond anything that's ever been imagined. So the angel announces the judgment of his hand. By visualizing victory ahead, Jesus is able to endure the cross. Read Hebrews 12, 1-4. I think I will.
When did you put that part in there about Jesus having that vision? Because you're saying these people are also being given a vision.
You're right. I'm going to get there. Now, therefore, Hebrews 12:1 says this. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, we talked about this on one of our Monday nights here, about how our relatives and everybody are looking over the balconies of heaven, watching our behaviors, you know, the saints that have gone on before us. We talked about the fact there's some things you don't do when your mama's in the room, right? Or the principal, or, you know, whatever, the pastor. Since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, and the writer of Hebrews here means since the saints who have gone on before us, including those who know us, are looking over the balconies of heaven, encouraging us to do the right thing. Since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. The writer of Hebrews, and you'll see this when you study sanctification, the writer of Hebrews says, put your sin aside. Sin aside. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. Just don't have it anymore. Okay? Get rid of it. Unfortunately, for 40 years, almost 50 years now, we have been telling people that they can't not sin. In Jesus' day, when he came to preach his gospel, he said, the rabbis for the last centuries have lowered the standards so that they brought them down low enough for you to keep them. And he says, it was not so. You've heard it said, you shall not kill your brother. I tell you, you can't even call him a fool. You've heard it said, blah, blah, blah. I tell you, you've heard it said you can't commit adultery. You know, y'all can keep that. I mean, everybody in here can skip the adultery thing, okay? But I tell you, if you look at a woman with lust, you've committed adultery. Jesus said, here's where the standard was. This is what God called us to. The rabbis have lowered the standard because, you know, they like it that you buy them, you know, give them a nice house and buy them a good car. They've lowered the standard so you can keep them. Paul says that in the last days, men will be so wicked that they will hire for themselves preachers who will come and tickle their ears. In other words, let's hire pastors who will tell us that the things we're doing are okay, instead of pastors who will come and challenge us to holiness, and pastors who will come and tell us what the Word of God really says. So he says here, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses around us, let's lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith. We need to be like Jesus. We need to model after Jesus. In Philippians 2, Paul says, have this mind in you, or this attitude which was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was equal with God, chose not to grasp or fight for equality with God, but taking on the form of a servant, he poured himself out, becoming human, and even unto death on the cross. You need to act like Jesus. Paul says that when God knows that your heart is toward him, that if you will work with him, he will predestine you to become conformed to the image of his Son. And I don't mean when you're dead. I mean now. So he says here, we need to fix our eyes on Jesus. We need to watch him. And because he's our model, that's who we're supposed to be like. Jesus says, I am meek and lowly of heart. Be like me. He said, you want to see the Father? You see me? You see the Father? Act like me. You will be one with the Father. Jesus called us to become like he is. We have been teaching people for way too long that that's not possible. And of course it's not possible for me to do it for myself in the flesh. But there's a miracle available to us that God wants to give us all, and that is to cause us to become like Christ. You know, back in the days of Jesus, people were laying hands on the sick and they were getting healed, and they were they were doing all kinds of miracles, okay? Why'd that stop? What is a good reason why that stopped? Is there any biblical reason that it should have stopped? And the answer is no, there's not. Huh? People cease to believe. And if you go to places like where the missionaries go, where they don't have a very strong Christian community and they depend upon the miracles of God to survive, these missionaries, they come back and they tell you these stories. Now, either all missionaries lie, or else something's happening differently in those places than happens here. The truth of the matter is that the power of God has not ebbed or waned, and I hate to use that word, has not ebbed or waned in the least. The power of God is every bit available to us. Jesus said, everything that I do and did, you will do and greater. You will do and greater. Now, every one of us have had some experience in our life where we saw a miracle. We saw someone turn. We saw something happen. We prayed and someone got healed. We've seen it. And some of us have had more than that. We'll see more when we expect more. And we will expect more miracles when we see the power of God in our own life shaping us and changing us to become who it is we're meant to be. And it's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. It's something that is given to us as inheritance that we can certainly call upon the Lord to ask him to enable us with. It's not something we do for ourselves. So he says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, becoming like him, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. Jesus embraced the cross because of the reward on the other side. Every good deed has two sides. There's an altruistic side and a whiffum. The altruistic side says, I need to do this because it's the right thing to do. In other words, I found this $100 on the ground. I know it belongs to Dan. I need to give it to Dan because it's the right thing to do. Okay? That's the altruistic part of it. The whiffum is it makes me feel good to do the right thing. You see what I'm saying? I might even get a reward. But the point is that every good deed that you do, you love your children. You love your children because you should, because it's the right thing to do. But there's great joy in doing the right thing. There always is. There's great reward in doing the right thing. So we mustn't think that there's something wrong with this. We're told Jesus endured the cross because of the reward that came. The reward is that he did the will of his Father. He received his Father say, well done, good and faithful servant. He saved his brethren. He restored his kin, his folk. He saved all of us. Jesus looked at all of us gathering at his feet, happy and fulfilled and grateful, And that was plenty of reward for him. So the scripture says that he endured the cross, despising the shame. You know, I know from your study, that there was no more despicable way to die in the ancient world than to be crucified. And the Jews believed, as did many, I mean even the Romans believed, that for someone to die on the cross was an ignominious death, and it meant you were cursed. If you were in the arena, if you died in a gladiatorial fight, that was an honorable death. If they turned the dogs loose on you and they just ripped you to shreds, that was the worst possible way to die. Besides being slow, it was also ugly. And it was considered a curse. For someone to die on the cross or crucifixion was considered a curse. Cursed is he who hangs on a tree, the proverb says. So he endured the cross, not just the pain and all of that sort of thing, but the shame of it. We're told he endured all that, and he sat down at the right hand of the Father, at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. Seeing what Jesus endured and what all he embraced for the sake of what it would get him, and yet you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood and you're striving against sin. In other words, Paul's saying, we don't yet have any real reason to complain because we haven't even begun, we haven't even shed any blood yet in the process of striving against sin. So, by visualizing the victory ahead, Jesus was able to endure the cross. And the victory that he was envisioning is this moment in time, this second coming, this getting ready to come back, this point in which the plan of God is going to be demonstrated, in which God is going to win, in which all the people who are faithful are going to be rewarded. We all want the teacher to come back into the classroom and catch the bad guys and deal with them so that peace can be restored to our classroom. We all want to see the evil man get his comeuppance. I mean, I've been in movie theaters when people got up and clapped when the bad guy finally got it. And you know, one of the devices of Hollywood is to make the bad guy as bad as possible. That's right. And when he gets his comeuppance, it is such a thrill. And there's this tension in there of like, you know, it's like a tightly strung bow. It's kind of like, he's worse than bad. And bam, he gets it. And everybody just goes crazy. You know, the tension's released. We want to see good triumph. And Jesus was looking to see a good triumph. And he knew there would come this time when all of this would come to pass. There will come a day. The second coming will come. This eastern sky will split. We'll see them on the horse. Some generation will be there. And if we're not there when it happens, we'll be coming back with him if we endure to the end. So John is writing to his people, you know, you need to hang in there because the reward on this is going to be so over the top. And the penalty for failing is going to be so unspeakable. You need to hang in with this. And that's his message. Next week we're going to study this lesson, which I called Payback is a Poodle Named Fifi. I'll let you all figure that out. Because we're going to begin to see the wrath of God fall on these people. Questions? Comments? Well, you know, that's an excellent point. Here's the deal. If you are sitting around waiting for the rapture, and all you've done is prepared yourself for the rescue mission, okay? In other words, you haven't really built up any spiritual muscle, because you're going to get raptured out. You don't have to, okay? And then the tribulation comes, you're in trouble. If you prepare yourself for the tribulation, and I'm wrong, and the rapture comes, well, you're going to be buff anyway, right? I mean, so the point is that one of the reasons why we're called, all of us, every generation of Christians, to walk before the Lord, to become stronger, to become more like Christ, to receive the gift that's been given to us, to become bigger, more mature Christians, people who've grown and developed and become sanctified. We've been called for that for a number of reasons. One is so we can stand in the difficult day. I mean, Nancy and I lost a child at 17 and a half. I've had three cancers. We've lost all kinds of stuff. God has been with us. We've lost nothing. Not anything permanent. We got a boy who's on the other side through a door. We'll see him again. I've lost some body parts that are, you know, negotiable anyway. And You know, we've lost a little money. It's not a big deal. We have everything we need. But we haven't lost anything permanent. We haven't lost anything permanent. And so the deal is that one of these days, we're going to step over here in this glorified body with our boy, you know, and all of that's going to be nothing. And the guy who had all of that and didn't have the Lord is going to be outside looking in, cursing himself for his foolishness. Now, I'm sorry about that. I mean, I hate that. But that's the reality of it. So, yeah, one of the reasons why we're meant to walk with the Lord, to go on with the Lord, to grow with the Lord as God gives us the strength and whatever. Because God does this work. We don't do it ourselves. We just invite him to do it. We just need to understand we need to invite him to do it, to expect it, to see that it's scripturally appropriate. But one of the reasons is so we can stand. Another is so we can lead those whom we love so that they don't get lost. I mean, it's one thing for me and Nancy to be able to stand in the difficult day. Do I want my grandchildren to all suffer under it because we're strong and they're not and they got crushed by it? I want to be able to lead them so that they can stand too. And I can't be a moral force for their benefit if I'm not myself sanctified. You see what I'm saying? At some level, I mean, I've told you this story before. When I used to smoke 15 cigars a day. In fact, it's in the book there. But one of the problems is that I was addicted, and I didn't care. You know, I was from Kentucky, and you know, we smoked in the crib. And so when my kids began to smoke as teenagers, I began to be troubled by that, because even though I didn't think there was anything wrong with it, I was really concerned for them. And so I wanted them to stop smoking, but I had no moral authority to tell them to stop. I could say the words, but I had no power, no spiritual power in it. And so I begged God for 2 years until he miraculously took it away from me. And then they quit. But I want to be able to, not just for my own ability to stand in the day, but I also want to lead those that I love. I want to guide those that I love to the same promised land, to the same place of victory. So if sometimes one of my points in the book is that sometimes the best motivation for sanctification is for the sake of others, for the sake of others. I mean, we all know this. If we, you know, I mean, how many we grew up in a generation where they all told us not to drink, but they had like 18 bottles of scotch, you know, sitting on the counter. I mean, you know, you know what I'm saying? It's really hard to say to somebody, you shouldn't do this when we're guilty ourselves. Comments. I'm overdue here. Comments, questions. It's a really good point. Are we getting it? Are we understanding the book of Revelation? It's not that hard, right? Isn't it getting clearer to you? I mean, are we not seeing it? Yes.
We are not alive for the tribulation, like the people in this room. We will not go through the tribulation.
Not alive, no. Yeah, the tribulation will only affect those who are alive on the earth. Anybody who's gone on to be with the Lord is going to be in that balcony looking over, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. No, if we die before the beginning of the tribulation, we will not experience the tribulation.
But you said something about coming back.
Well, when the Lord comes back, all the saints of God, all of the born-again people are going to come back with him. But he's coming back at the end of the tribulation. Okay.
To
rule and reign on the earth for 1,000 years, the millennial reign. He's going to come back to do several things. First, he's going to dump on the world the wrath. We're getting ready to get into that. We are going to what's called the marriage feast of the Lamb. We'll get into that as well. But it's basically the place where we get together and celebrate the marriage between us and Christ while his people are out there cleaning the plow of the world. And then after he gets done with all of that and the world's rebuilt and reshaped and all that sort of thing, then those who survive all of that will go on with the normal human life for 1,000 years with Jesus ruling and reigning and us ruling and reigning with him, the scripture says. At the end of that time, then we go to heaven. But well, the tribulation is a 7-year period, and it's more intense at one time than another. But yes, it's normal human living. The tribulation is normal human life. The scripture says Jesus said it'll be like in the days of Noah. Right up to the point that he closed the doors. They were marrying and giving and marrying and partying and having a good time. In fact, Jesus says to some one of the places, he said, pray that your flight would not be on a Sabbath, or that you're not with child. You know, if difficulty comes, you don't want that to... You know, there's no law that says, okay, I'm getting ready to dump on the earth so there'll be no pregnancies 9 months ago. Or no, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Everything is just going along normal, and he's just going to insert himself right in the middle of it. Other comments? Yes?
You said how it's just clear cut. You're either with Christ or you're with the Antichrist.
Yeah, you will be, yes.
And,
right now it's a lot of gray, hon.
Yeah.
Okay, who's going to pray us out?